So on the question of whether to move Albert Camus' remains, the French left has called Sarkozy an intellectual gravedigger, and the Conservatives are full of praise. Robert Zaretsky is Professor of French History at the University of Houston, and he's been following the debate, and he's also just published a book on Camus called Elements of a Life. Robert Zaretsky, welcome to the book show.
Thank you, Ramon. It's good to be here.
Robert, what is motivating Sarkozy?
Well, of course, only Sarkozy can say what his motivations are. But everybody has a suspicion, and my guess is that Sarkozy is largely motivated by a desire to, in part, recuperate Camus' legacy. And this is a legacy that the French have been fighting over for some 50 years, ever since Camus' death in 1960. We've just marked the 50th anniversary of his death. And in fact, the announcement was to be made on the anniversary, which is the 4th of January. But Sarkozy has been unable to obtain the permission of Camus' children, which is essential for moving their father's body from its cemetery in southern France to the Pantheon. So I think it's largely political, but the Pantheon itself is a political gesture. It was created in a spasm of politics during the French Revolution, and it has remained very much a creature of French politics ever since. And as a consequence, what Sarkozy is doing is absolutely not out of the ordinary. Every act of pantheonization, in other words, in fact, that's a French verb. but every entombment of a French great man in the crypt of the Pantheon is by definition a political act.
Because you've made the point that it's changed identity many times over the years, depending on regimes. Give us an example of what's happened in there.
Well, you can trace this to to its very origins, Ramona. In 1792, the French First Republic, the French King, Louis XVI, had just been deposed, commandeered what was the then just completed Church of Sainte-Geneviève, who's the patron saint of Paris, and rebaptized it as the Pantheon, and it was designed to be a site for the great men of France, but a particular kind of France, namely a Republican France. And so the first bodies that were placed there was a important actor during the Revolution, the Count Mirabeau, and it was followed by Voltaire and then by Rousseau. But what's interesting, and here gives you one instance of the kind of musical chairs, the political musical chairs that's been played inside the crypt, when the Revolution moved to its bloodiest phase, the Terror, of 1794-95, a new actor who was instrumental in the Terror, his name is J.P. Marat, his body was moved in. He died. He was actually assassinated by Charlotte Corday, a painting that was immortalized by J.P. David in his painting of Corday's body in a milk-filled bathtub.
Yes.
And when Marat's body was moved in, Mirabeau's body was thrown out. It was pushed out because Mirabeau represented a certain kind of France that the Republic simply couldn't, because Mirabeau was fighting for a constitutional monarchy. So Mirabeau was pushed out, Marat was entombed, and then a year later, after the Terror fizzled and Robespierre, Saint-Just and company were all in turn beheaded, Marat's body was pushed out, and more conservative individuals were placed inside the tomb of the Pantheon.
So it's a kind of un-merry-go-round, really.
A very un-merry-go-round, a very grim merry-go-round. And while this is taking place in the crypt, the church itself is being passed or is being pushed back and forth between the church and the regime. Whenever France went through several republics in the 19th century, whenever it became a republic, the Pantheon became the Pantheon once again, and its task was once again to commemorate the memory of these great men. But when the Republic was overthrown, and that was the case three times during the course of that century, it was returned to the church. The inscription over the pediment, which reads in translation, "To great men, a grateful country," that was removed, and a cross was placed back on the dome, designed by Soufflot. So there are just dozens of instances in which the political identity or the ideological contents of the Pantheon have been debated by those who have one understanding of the French past and those who have a different idea of the French past.
Can we, getting back to Camus himself, I mean, he died young in a car accident. Do we know what he himself wanted for his future remains?
No, we don't. He died very young. He was scarcely 44 when a car he was a passenger in slammed into a tree in southern France. And of course, in the silence that has since followed, people have been all too willing to speak on his behalf, and I'm afraid that's even the case with me, what he would have wanted. And his son, he left twins, and his son Jean Camus said that his father would never have wanted this act to go through. He would never want to be placed inside the Pantheon. His daughter, Catherine Camus, is a bit more hesitant. On the one hand, she also dislikes the overt act of overtly political act on Sarkozy's part. But on the other hand, she believes that her father would have been happy to know that this gesture would be, yes, it would be something undertaken by Sarkozy's government, but would also recall to people's memories that her father always tried to speak for those who were voiceless. During his lifetime, he was very allergic to public honors. He refused the Legion of Honor after the Second World War. And during the war, he actually served as the editor of the most important resistance newspaper, Combat, and his life was at risk.
Well, quite apart from the fact that, I mean, he wrote The Stranger, L'Étranger, or The Outsider, and a lot of people, conflate that book with an idea of him as an outsider rather than as an insider in the Pantheon.
Right. Well, that's. I mean, he's an outsider in so many respects, and to place him in the Pantheon, in one sense, I think would comfort Camus insofar as he saw himself. Well, let me try to explain. He was French, but he was a particular kind of Frenchman. He was a French Algerian. He was born in a working-class neighborhood of Algiers in 1913. His father died the following year in the Battle of the Marne. He never knew his father. His mother was a cleaning woman, and Camus was basically pushed through a Republican school system in Algiers by the good graces of the Republican state. He was taken in charge following the father's death, and Camus was always grateful, I think, to the French Republic for that, and he always believed that the French Republican ideology, at its best, was a good and great thing. And hence his torment over Algeria, because here was his nation, France, basically ruling a country where some 1 million Pieds-Noirs, people like himself, namely European colonists living in Algeria with French citizenship, were masters, and there were some 8 to 8.5 million indigenous peoples, Berbers and Arabs, living under them. Who were disenfranchised, disempowered, very much secondary. And one of the things he tried to do his entire life was somehow square this imperialist circle by saying that the French had to take their Republican ideology seriously, apply to those living in Algeria to make them full citizens as well. And he never succeeded, of course, and it was one of the great tragedies, if not the greatest tragedy of his life.
What did he mean when he said that France would have to conquer Algeria a second time?
Well, he said that in a series of editorials that he was writing in the mid-1950s as the Algerian War was beginning to become ever bloodier. And by that he meant that if you look at the first conquest of Algeria, which began in 1829 under Charles X, the last Bourbon king, it was purely military. The designs were imperial, and they were coated with the sheen of humanist values. And Camus said, we need to take what we've done seriously. we now find ourselves having absorbed not just this territory, but more than 8 million people, and we need to make them fully French. And so if we're going to conquer Algeria, we have to win them, we have to win their hearts and minds. And we can only do that if we regard them as fully equal. And so he wanted to apply in all seriousness that great revolutionary trilogy of values, equality, liberty, and fraternity, to all the peoples of Algeria. But by the time he began to act politically to do this in the 1950s, actually he began to do this in the 1930s as a journalist for an obscure Algerian newspaper, but the logic of events had reached such a point by the 1950s that it was simply too late. There was no time left to conquer Algeria a second time at that point.
But as his reputation built with the publication of books like The Stranger or The Outsider, The Myth of Sisyphus and The Plague, all sides in the debate were eager to co-opt Camus for their own purposes. But after 1956, he fell quiet. Why?
Well, he fell quiet because there were two reasons. By 1955, 1956, there is this lull in his career. He's afraid that he's absolutely exhausted artistically, that he has nothing more to write as an artist. And it was a fear that haunted him during the better part of the 1950s, especially after his falling out with Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, and that circle after 1952. The other reason why he does fall silent is that after 1956, he realizes that there's nothing more to be said, nothing more to be done on behalf of a political settlement in Algeria. He's tried his best. He actually flew to Algiers from Paris at the behest of friends in Algiers to make one last pitch for what he called a civilian truce, something that he had been arguing for in the pages of L'Express, a French weekly magazine, namely that at the very least the two sides in the conflict, the French army and the FLN, needed to agree that civilians should be spared. If they're going to continue killing, at least they should kill only one another, and to leave civilians alone. He flew to Algiers, he gave a speech in a central hall in Algiers, a speech that was nearly overrun by Algerian French nationalists. Thousands of people had mobbed the square. They were trying to break into the hall. They were throwing rocks through the window. And Camus was speaking during this this burgeoning riot. It was an amazingly dramatic moment in his life. And then he was finally hustled out of the hall by a group of old childhood friends. And after that visit to Algiers, he realized there was nothing more that he could do or say, at least as a political actor, and he fell silent. And he actually broke that silence twice, but the most notable moment was in 1957. After winning the Nobel Prize, he traveled to Stockholm to accept it. And 2 days after his official address to the Swedish Academy, he went to the University of Uppsala to have a give and take with students. And soon after it began, a young Algerian student and Algerian Arab rose up in the audience and began to harass him, hector him, shout at him about his bad faith and why had he fallen silent given the killings that were taking place in Algeria and given the instances of torture, so on and so forth, by the French army against both French citizens as well as Arabs and Berbers. And he wouldn't let Camus respond. And finally Camus succeeded in interrupting the young man, said, "Give me the right that you're demanding of your compatriots in Algeria." And then he said that he had fought for justice all of his life, which is in fact the case. And he had tried to do so in Algeria too. But when it came to, and he loved justice, but at the end of the day, if it's a choice between justice and his mother, he loves his mother more. And his mother was still living in that same working-class district of Algiers. She refused to leave for France, even though her son begged her several times to do so. And it was a remark that immediately circled the world when he made it, and it's been, and it's still being interpreted in so many different ways by commentators and the like.
What do you make of the fact, Robert Zaretsky, that this debate over Camus' burial site is happening at the same time as a vigorous debate over the wearing of the veil in France?
Well, it's not at all surprising. In one sense, of course, the two debates have to do with two very different issues, but they both point to one of the great concerns of French today, namely, what does it mean to be French? How can we be French? And so the debate, for example, it's not a debate over the veil in France. It's really a debate over the burqa, namely the covering, that traditional clothing that covers not just the hair but the entire face except a thin slit for the eyes. That's what they're trying to... the veil has been more or less decided that this can't be worn, for example, in schools, most important. But now there is a law has been recently introduced, or at least it's now being debated in the National Assembly, about whether the burqa should be banned in public. And it's causing a huge controversy in France. But the politics over the veil and its presence in public schools, the politics over the burqa, the politics over Camus' body, all have to do with this sense of Frenchness. How do we define being French? Can one be both Algerian and French? Can one wear a veil? Can one wear a burqa and still be fully French? Can one, for example, in Camus' case, can one be both born in Algiers, be true not just to France, but also to certain universal ideals or values that France failed to apply in Algeria until its independence in 1962.
So if you, just finally, Robert, if you were a betting man, do you think Camus will end up at the Pantheon?
I am a betting man, but I'm not sure I really want to bet on this particular event. My sense is no. I think that Catherine Camus, who's going to have the final say, is in the end going to decide to let her father rest in Lormoran, which is the cemetery where he now is in southern France.
Well, Robert Zaretsky, thank you so much for being on the Book Show today.
Well, thank you, Ramona. I really appreciated it.
And Robert is Professor of French History at the University of Houston, and his latest book is called Albert Camus, Elements of a Life, and it's published by Cornell University Press.